Welcome to episode 3 of Teaching to Meet the Moment from the Center to Support Excellence in Teaching here at Stanford University's Graduate School of Education. I'm Mike Hines.
And I'm Nicole Luciani-Elliott.
In today's episode, we're talking about culturally sustaining content in our classrooms.
Mike, I'm wondering, before we get started, if you can give us some historical background here on education and how cultural and linguistic identities have not been a part of the conversation historically.
In terms of the history on this one, schools have been battlegrounds over questions of identity and language, citizenship, race, culture, really since the beginning of American public education in the mid-19th century. Part of the purpose of public education, as early schoolmen like Horace Mann imagined it and wrote about it, was to strip away the cultures of Black, Indigenous, Latinx, and even Eastern and Southern European students, and to replace those supposedly alien cultures with an assimilated, Americanized identity, right? One that was based on the norms of native-born, white, Protestant, middle-class people.
Mm. That resonates so strongly with me. My grandparents on both sides were Italian immigrants and came and faced that very thing. Like, you're going to go to prison, so you might as well just drop out. And there was no conversation about any kind of celebration or honoring of cultures or languages. And at that point, I don't know that Italian was considered, I think it was considered white at that point. So we're not just necessarily talking about race here, although that was certainly the a primary function of this shutting down that you're talking about. I'm wondering how people who didn't meet this narrow construct of school culture and what would match up with school culture, how did they push back historically?
I think, you know, there's always been like this steady sort of drumbeat of resistance that sort of moves consistently and constantly throughout the history of American education. So whether we want to think of Black teachers in the Reconstruction era, right, who were fashioning their own curriculum from scratch, whether we want to think about cultural pluralist educators or intercultural education in the 1930s and 40s, that was really trying to rewrite what it meant to be an American and American identity, whether we want to talk about students and activists in the 1960s and 70s who walked out of their classrooms, right, in L.A. and Chicago and Denver, right, to demand curricula that spoke to their own backgrounds and needs. And then right up to the present with movements like Teaching for Black Lives, right? Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, the resistance to those sort of culturally inauthentic, curricula have always been there. And it's easy to trace that line through American history.
And in the last decade in particular, it felt like we were making some good progress. I know you and I are both in the field of history and thinking about how we teach history, even from when I started teaching in 1995 to when I left the classroom in 2014, it felt like we were starting to make some progress. And then this last few years, we hit a pretty significant pushback, at least on the national level. I think maybe I have two questions just for you and as a historian. First of all, is that kind of pushback pretty normal when we see progress? And then secondly, tell us about that pushback and any context you can offer, any kind of thoughts for where that came from and why.
I think it's pretty natural. I think there's always sort of this pattern of forward movement and then, you know, reaction or retrenchment right from those in power, right? So I think really what we have to be focused on here and really what explains some of the pushback is that, you know, these pushes for more culturally relevant curricula threaten those in power, right? And so we should expect that that those in power aren't going to take that line down. For example, we had in 2019, right, the New York Times released their 1619 project, which really tried to reframe our national narrative around the role of slavery and its impact and its implications even into the present. And that started this massive national conversation. Right? But then, you know, the very next year, there's this backlash. Right? And we saw it with the formation of the 1776 Commission by the Trump administration. And its report, which was released just a few days back, just last week, calling for patriotic education, quote unquote, with the purpose of, you know, instilling students with a love of their country. And then that gets dissolved almost immediately by the Biden administration only days later, right? So I think it's safe to say that these battles over race and identity in American education are far from over, right? And that they're as present and they're as pressing right now as they ever have been, really, in our nation's history.
Yeah, thank you. So today, everybody, we're taking on the conversation of kind of this latest iteration of what it means to honor identities and languages in the classroom. And I think there's two things that we need to say as we go into this conversation. One, we use the phrase culturally sustaining content choices today. And there are definitely nuances between the phrases culturally sustaining, culturally responsive, culturally relevant. We're not intending to use those things synonymously, but rather creating this kind of umbrella of a conversation about what it means to really honor the cultures and languages of our kids and of ourselves, and so that we can all show up as full humans in our classroom to learn. And maybe even to think about how it allows all of us to become more culturally and linguistically dexterous in our globalized world. So again, we're not looking to make these synonymous, but we are kind of looking to create kind of a big tent to talk about all of them together. The second thing we want to name is that we've split this conversation into two parts, and we know that curriculum and instruction are inextricably tied together, that you can't separate them. We really wanted to create enough space to talk about them both. And so even though curriculum and instruction are deeply intertwined, our intention is not to separate them from one another completely, but rather tease them apart kind of gently to give enough time to really talk about the nuances of each. So today we're talking about content choices and sources and texts and all sorts of things that go into building a curriculum, and how we might think about choosing sources that are really sustaining of our kids' cultures and languages. Also a reminder that nobody here is considered an expert. We're in conversation about things that matter so that we can meet the moment as it calls us to do. So to that end, we've got four really extraordinary friends and colleagues among us that I'd love to go ahead and introduce you to. Mike, is that okay if I go ahead and jump in there?
Absolutely. I'm really excited for our guest today.
Great. So first we have Vielka Hoy, who is my friend and colleague at CSET. She's a 20-year veteran in the classroom, mostly teaching high school history and social studies. Her graduate work is centered on the African diaspora, a framework she incorporated in her work in the classroom and at CSET, where she coaches early career teachers in our Hollyhock Fellowship. Vielka is also the CEO and founder of Bridge to College, which is a data analytics company that matches students to colleges that are financial, social, and academic fits. So thank you to Vielka for coming.
Thanks for having me.
Lauren Beal is next. Lauren is a practitioner, a student-driven, enthusiastic, and dedicated social studies teacher who is committed to inquiry-based learning that connects the past to the present. Originally from Los Angeles, Lauren earned her bachelor's and teacher credential in history from Fresno State and continues to reside in Fresno, where she teaches grades 10 to 12 at Edison High School, and she's been there for about 6 years. Lauren has spearheaded the introduction of ethnic studies at Edison by championing African-American studies as a course, and is now in her third year piloting this course. Welcome to Lauren.
Thank you so much for having me today. I'm honored to be in community with you all.
I'm so grateful that you're here. Andrew is here. He's an educator, musician, and theater performer in the Twin Cities. As a native of Minnesota, Andrew earned his bachelor's in life science secondary ed with a minor in music. And Andrew, I'm going to need you to help me. How do we say the name of your school? Gustavus?
Gustavus.
Oh, there you go. What's the next one? Gustavus.
Adolphus College.
College. Thank you.
There you go.
He has been teaching college-level secondary life science at Fridley High School for the last 10 years. In addition to being a science educator, he coaches an after-school improv troupe and co-advises the school's performing arts club. Andrew has a passion for making classrooms more inclusive and culturally responsive. And as an instructional leader, he has observed and coached teachers and created staff development opportunities related to culturally responsive pedagogy. Welcome to Andrew.
Thank you so much for having me.
And finally, my dear friend Lydia McClanahan is here. She's a veteran ELA teacher who began teaching her career at Crenshaw High School in Los Angeles. She began her journey in cultural and linguistic responsiveness in 1998 as a facilitator for LAUSD's Academic English Mastery Program and went on to become one of the founding middle school teachers at the Culture and Language Academy of Success. During her time at class, Lydia began serving as an instructional coach for the Center for Culturally Responsive Teaching and Learning with Dr. Shiraki Holly. She's also served as a lead instructional coach for the center since 2013 and has created a website and program called Responsive Reads, which is a website and Bookstagram that illuminates diverse authors and culturally authentic texts as well as lesson ideas. So we have a full panel of extraordinary people. Welcome to Lydia and everybody else. Thank you.
Thank you so much for being here, Andrew, Lydia, Lauren, Kiyoka. I want to jump right in because we've got such a great panel and such a timely topic today. So the first question that I would really want to put to each one of you is simply, how would you define culturally relevant curricula or culturally relevant content? And why do you think it's so important or so central to the work that we do? I want to start with Lauren, and then we can have others jump in as well.
I think that, wow, I always go back to my first year of teaching, I would say, and Bielko was actually my coach at Hollyhock, and if I just knew like a tenth of what I know now in terms of like addressing students' identity and their whole selves before you even get to like your lesson planning, right? I feel like in terms of culturally relevant or culturally sustaining content, you have to first know who your students are, not who you think they are. And I think that was just my mistake in growth as a teacher. I just assumed a lot of ways of like, well, students will like this. Instead of first taking that really step to say, okay, who are my students, right? Before I teach you and open up this book about, you know, anything, right? In terms of American history, who are you? What are you bringing into this classroom? And not just based off of race and ethnicity, right? All the intersectionalities that, you know, students and teenagers bring into the classroom. And from there, you could start to build your curriculum. From there, you could start to build your content. And it becomes so much more impactful, and the students will give you such remarkable work, such greater, such in-depth work, because they're able to basically be themselves in your classroom, but also be critically conscious about the world around them, critically conscious of what you're even showing them, what you're teaching them, right? Pushing back against statements of their classmates, et cetera. So I really believe the first step is definitely like authentically getting to know your students and the lives and the lived experiences of themselves, the community in which you teach, and the history of that community would be my first step.
So much. Bielka, I saw you nodding. I saw you smiling as Lauren was speaking. Do you want to add to that or just second that?
I would second it. I mean, Lauren's a great protege. not that I had much to do with that, but I agree. I think the one nuance is that I think sometimes people misconstrue culturally relevant to be too specific to who's in the room at that time. You know, in history, we'll say, oh, we have a student from Cambodia this year, so I'll teach the Khmer Rouge this time. but that doesn't lend to being sustaining, right? Because we're not developing curriculum that is answering questions. We're just really focused on these events, a specific person, as though these things don't exist anymore. when that particular student wasn't there. So I'd second what Lauren is saying, just add that we have to be really specific about what we mean about the who is present in the room and what we're, what part of them we're teaching.
It's way more complicated than we usually think. Thanks. Lydia or Andrew? Either one of you want to add?
Oh, so Lydia. I would just say that I think on the importance of culturally relevant, culturally responsive teaching, when I think about our marginalized students and the lack of success that they've had in the institutions, why would they care about whatever it is that the institution is trying to teach them when that very institution has not cared about who they are? And so when we bring culturally relevant, culturally responsive instruction and begin that with validating and affirming and showing that we have love and that we care about who these children are that are coming to us and care about their experiences, and we use and illuminate their experiences in the classroom, then we can use that as a bridge because they know that we care, right? So then we can kind of use that as the bridge to why they might want to care about this other stuff that we're trying to teach them.
That's really interesting. The idea of building bridges from what your students care about already, who they are already, right? What they value, what they bring to the classroom, and then using that as a bridge to get to the content, and then using that as a determinant of where you go with the content, right, is really interesting and resonates with me a lot. Andrew, did you want to add any?
So many amazing things have already been shared. I would only add, you know, that when I'm considering my curricular choices as a science teacher, the curriculum can be pretty rigid and prescribed. And, you know, even though science itself is hopefully an unbiased and sort of neutral third party, the story of science and the discoveries and what it tells us about the people of the world and our place in it is anything but biased. And so I want my students to see themselves in my curriculum. And, you know, it happens to be that I work in a school that has a pretty diverse student body. I would feel that way even if I didn't. But the point is that I want what they come and see and learn and experience in my room to be as much of a reflection of their experiences and their home cultures as I can bring.
Thanks. Thanks.
So we're focused today on content choices and curriculum choices. And so I'm going to ask each of you a question that's nuanced to your particular work. Specifically, I want to think about how you approach finding content and bringing it into the classroom. And I know Lydia is a specialist in ELA and has kind of a framework for text selection that really would work no matter your content area. So I'd like, Lydia, for you to talk us through that framework. And then I'm going to ask Vielka to weigh in because in history, as history teachers, we're given these very Eurocentric standards. And I wonder how you push back against that and or use that to create a different lens when you're thinking about supporting teachers and in building a more responsive and sustaining curriculum, including how you did it when you were in the classroom. So, Lydia, let's start with you and have us have you walk us through the framework that you've developed.
OK, so I really didn't develop this. This is sort of a combination of work that I've done with Dr. Holly and other educators. Basically, it has us looking at how we're selecting texts that we think are diverse or that we think are representative of various groups of people and various cultural groups. And so we look at three types of text: culturally authentic, culturally generic, and then culturally neutral. And we start by saying that all diverse text, I'm using air quotes, diverse texts are not created equal, because just because you see someone that is brown on a cover of a book, or just because a character has a certain name, just because there's the name Kwame in the text, does not mean that it authentically represents a culture's experiences accurately, right? So we want educators to be mindful and to think and read critically when they're looking at text. And so culturally authentic text is a text that one is told from a perspective that is authentic to the group of people it's supposed to represent. It is not told from a dominant perspective. It's told from a marginalized or absent narrative perspective. And it really illuminates the authentic experiences, deep, nuanced, cultural rings of culture, intersectionality experiences of that group. And it doesn't contain misinformation or stereotypes. It doesn't make you feel a kind of way when you read it and think this something is wrong about this, right? It really gives the reader a that's me feeling when they're like, oh, this is about me. This is about my neighborhood. This is about my family. This is what my family does when they, you know, go to this event or have this experience. And that's really what a culturally authentic text does, right? A culturally generic text may have representations of diverse groups of people, but they're more superficial. Not that it's problematic to have these types of texts, but we don't want teachers using a culturally generic text and say, well, this text has all these characters of or people of different racial groups and have them thinking that it is representative of authentic culture, right? The themes, the issues in a culturally generic text are more universal, right? Or may appeal to maybe youth culture more than they do to a certain ethnic group. But the culture represented is not as deep and nuanced as in a culturally authentic text. And then finally, the last one is a culturally neutral text. And these are texts that really just have sort of tokenistic representations of groups of people. You know, like I said, they have the people on the cover. They have a name of a certain person, or the person looks like it might represent me. But when I read the text, there's nothing that reflects who I am or my experiences at all. And that's like the text that we want people to kind of gravitate to the least. So that's sort of the loose framework in a nutshell.
Thanks. Bielka, how does this look in a history classroom? Because when we think about our history textbooks, I'm thinking it hits the generic land of the framework pretty squarely, or maybe there's one little corner sidebar. Talk to us about how, when you were a teacher, you kind of pushed back, especially in the community where you were teaching, to create a more sustaining experience for our kids, and maybe what you advise the teachers you now coach.
Yeah, I probably go to the step right before the text selection. And I think, you know, one of the big mistakes that we make as teachers when we're well-meaning and we want to do culturally relevant, and we say, we're going to toss out all of Europe. And I'm like, well, World War II is going to be kind of hard to teach. So you can't necessarily do that. I think the way we do it in an appropriate way is to first start with questions. And these are mostly like how or why type of inquiry questions. And for me, when I was in the classroom, I use Paul Gilroy's text of Black Atlantic a lot, just in this theory that something fundamentally changed when Columbus left. And we know world history, U.S. history starts around this same point in time. And it's around this time that Gilroy argues something changed. And he argues that it's essentially the commodification of bodies, be those enslaved Africans or indigenous people. And everything that resulted thereafter stemmed from that commodification. So I taught assuming the timeline starts at that point. So the in world history, right, the French Revolution is about a commodification of the third estate, right? Where 1619 Project picks up, Jamestown is about the commodification of enslaved Africans, like, and we sort of take off from there. But once you sort of establish that question, why you're starting the timeline where you're starting, then you could keep asking more questions and frame the whole thing as a set of questions. You know, what I used to do in U.S. history was, it was three questions for me. How have we come to define Americans over time? How have we come to define this version of American democracy? And how have we come to define this version of American capitalism? And everything I'm picking is just to help me answer that question. So then I go to the events, right? So then it's, okay, where does the Trail of Tears fit? And why is it important to understand the civil rights movement in those, within those three questions? And then you don't get, you know, I think on its own, right, 1776 commission was all bad. but I think if we look at it from this sort of social scientific lens, it lacked historiography, it lacked science, right? There wasn't a hypothesis, there wasn't evidence. I mean, the whole thing went through without even a footnote, but that was, which I was like, how did they manage to do that? Because there's certainly plenty of racist people they could have quoted, but they managed to do that without that. So I think it's just develop that inquiry, mm-hmm. then teach students how to find appropriate evidence to answer your inquiry, mm-hmm. And then how do you create conclusions based on the evidence that you found. Mm-hmm. And then I think it becomes inherently culturally sustaining.
So for you, it's about the questions and how the questions guide your choices, and then how we set up our students to do inquiry so that they can answer those questions in an informed way. And in that process, I'm creating a sustaining environment.
Right, right. I just did a content cluster just before this, and it was the same piece of advice. Like this particular teacher has a lot of conservative students, and my thought was, I'm not saying that going to Breitbart, for example, is wrong. I'm saying, show me the evidence, show me the argument, show me the thesis, and prove me wrong. Maybe I missed it, right? And if that's the case, then we can move on. But I also think in doing it this way, in terms of setting up inquiries, it's not the sort of, you know, it's February, time to talk about Black people version either. You know, like, you always have an insertion point, mm-hmm. if you're being authentic to these stories, mm-hmm. And you don't have to sort of make up reasons to talk about certain groups too.
Right, right, right. And just for the audience, a content cluster is
a
group of teachers who we meet with at CSET and work on their practice. They give each other feedback. It's a structure that we use for instructional coaching. Thank you. So Andrew, all of this talk about text selection and literature and historiography, you teach science. So the question of the hour is, how does this even work in a STEM universe? A lot of folks will argue that that STEM is neutral, that there is, you know, you're not taking a position when you teach science. It's just the facts. Let's just tell me what you think about how this looks in science, Andrew.
If I could jump in.
Please.
We've had a question in the Q&A that ties in here. People are excited, Andrew, to hear from you, and they don't want to just hear about science. They're also very curious about how you weave music into your classroom as well.
You know, like I said before, the story of science and the meaning of science is anything but biased. Sorry, I said that backwards. It is, if you truly look at what has been the story of scientific discovery and the implications that it has for society, you will see bias and white privilege everywhere. You know, I want my students to know that science is not owned by a small subset of dead white guys. And so one of the ways that, you know, we start the year is by talking about students' identities and their rings of culture. And just sort of setting that that framework and that foundation for how we can incorporate those things in at various points in the curriculum. And once you've got that baseline, it's almost difficult not to think of ways to connect various scientific topics to your students, to their identities, and to their experiences. You know, my textbooks don't do that very well. They're written slowly and they're not updated very often. So I don't know if you're going to find a ton of help there. But one of the things that I'm doing constantly is, you know, you scour the internet, you find articles, you find things that are new and contemporaneous and up to date, that tell these stories. They tell about these discoveries, or they connect these discoveries. And so I really think that the authentic history of science and the true meaning of what it does for us is much more powerful when you look at it through a lens of equity and social justice. So, you know, for every time that I kind of have to talk about Gregor Mendel and Punnett squares, you know, I'm thinking to myself, okay, so I'm bringing a white guy into my room, and I feel now that there's like the imperative to diversify that, to bring in other stories that aren't just that. So again, so that my students can see themselves in what I'm teaching. So, you know, I'm going to, you know, bring in Henrietta Lacks, and, you know, we're going to keep these conversations sort of referencing back to culture. And once you've got that in your classroom dialogue day to day, it isn't really like a weird 180 when you're talking about the polygenic trait of skin pigmentation. And then that leads to a conversation about adaptation to your environment. And then we can talk about how, you know, the Inuit peoples have darker skin than their latitude would predict based on like European ancestry, and how that's related to vitamin D in their diets, and how people with darker skin suffer more from seasonal affect disorder during the winter months. And, you know, there's a lot of vulnerability in that sometimes for me, because, you know, I don't know what I don't know, and I make mistakes all the time. But you just have to jump in. You have to try it, and you have to see how your students receive it. And so, you know, there's really connections to rings of culture and students' identity all over the scientific spectrum. You know, if you want to talk about natural selection and adaptation and genetics, I can give my kids an article about the Bajau people of Indonesia, who are showing physical and genetic adaptations to diving and being underwater for great periods of time. You know, I can challenge cultural norms. So when we're talking about, you know, the heart and blood, I can show them a video of the Maasai nomadic tribes drinking cow blood. And that doesn't just change the lesson, it changes the conversation about like what a cultural norm is. And, you know, most people in America wouldn't necessarily find drinking blood to be very appetizing. But there's that other perspective that this is a cultural norm and a cultural asset. It's something that can challenge their thinking and maybe show a little bit of what you would sort of think of as like a bias in the way you're perceiving diet and normal behavior. You know, we talk about biological sex and gender and what the differences between what your chromosomes encode and how people choose to identify. That leads to a natural conversation about nature versus nurture, and if people are born a certain way or if they find it along the way, which inevitably leads to a connection about orientation. You know, Alexander Fleming discovered antibiotics and fungus, but you could also note the evidence that ancient Nubians made antibiotic beer. Like, it's everywhere. You almost, I mean, once you start to open your eyes to those connections, it's almost difficult to find a subject in science that doesn't have some connection to a ring of culture or to a level of a student experience. And you just have to try as hard as you can to keep directing it away from dead white men. That's kind of been my approach.
So it takes a really intentional approach to being a learner, all right? Because none of us learned any of that in science ever. So you've got to really take on the onus of being a learner. And I think that's true for historians as well.
First, I hope that everybody was taking notes during that, because so thank you. And I want to circle back to something that I heard you say, and maybe use it as a jumping off point for a question. I think you said and it was sort of in passing, but you said, you know, my textbooks don't really do that very well. Right. Referring to culturally relevant material. And then you talked about an experience that I think we probably all have had as teachers, which is the scouring the internet, right, trying to pull material that's supplementary, that's not in your textbook. And I think, you know, even though arguably there's more and better access to culturally relevant content than has ever existed, right? I'm thinking of the 1619 Project. I'm thinking of some of the stuff that comes out of the Southern Poverty Law Center or the Zen Education Project, or, you know, right here at Stanford, the Stanford History and Education Group. At the same time, though, it feels like textbook publishers and school boards and districts are often lagging behind or actively working against that in some ways. So I want to open this question to everybody, but I want to start with maybe Lydia on this one. Do you have any ideas on where we start in terms of moving culturally relevant content from being out here on the margins, something that teachers have to go search for individually, to really moving towards the center of our education systems? How do we do that structural work?
Well, I would say that one, it made me think of when I first started teaching at Crenshaw High my first year. I was young. I was in my 20s. That was just 4 years ago, but I was in my early 20s. And I was excited because I was a Black teacher going in to teach Black students. And so I was all, you know, ready to do this. And so I went in and I had my Langston Hughes lesson plan already, right? And it was like an 11th grade class. And those students looked at me like, what is this? I am, you know, who is this man? He was still dead, right? He wasn't white and dead, but he was still dead. And this group of young people had no interest in what I was trying to do. I was excited about my lesson. And this was before, this is before internet and before all of that. And so I began to think of how I was going to excite them about Langston Hughes. And so I started sitting with them at lunch, listening to their conversations, listening to the music that they were listening to. And that's how I found a song. I think back then it was Lil Wayne's group, Hot Boys. I know y'all don't know anything about that. y'all too.
As an elder millennial, I know plenty about the Hot Boys.
Okay, you remember, absolutely. You remember. And I found a song, I found a Hot Boys song that I used to teach a lesson that then hooked them into what I was talking about with Langston Hughes. And so I think the answer to your questions is much easier now, right? It's much easier now to, I think, access. It's everywhere because of social media, right? We just, it's at our fingertips, right? All we have to do is follow Jason Reynolds or follow Elizabeth Acevedo's Instagram to find out what is relevant to young people, what these people are writing. So I think it's listening to our students and then doing the work. It still just requires us doing the work to get to know our students. And Lauren said that earlier. And then digging in and finding what will work.
So teachers, do the work. No more excuses. If I walk into another classroom and I see you only teaching Walter Dean Myers, or reading The House on Mango Street for the 511th time,
no excuse.
We have to have a conversation, right?
There's
more out there than that. I want to jump to Lauren on the same question, right? How do we start to move, not just as individual teachers even, but how do we start to make bigger pushes for more sort of systemic change? How do we get culturally relevant content to be the center of the curriculum instead of, you know, what Andrew was saying about, like, of course it's not in the textbooks.
I feel like a lot of teachers feel this way. I hope they do. I know I feel especially in my classroom, I control like what happens, right? And then when you get to the systemic district, you're like, oh my gosh, there's so much. So I think I'll start first in the classroom. I think that in my classroom, I really learned that I am like in control of what happens. And if you start there, you then can decide, okay, how do I want to make these instructional choices? So for myself in content, my textbook is and we just adopted a new textbook. And my textbook caused us to be on the news because a teacher said the N-word, a conversation that started off my history textbook. And it parlayed into something totally a wild scenario, let's put it that way. And the conversation that we were having in my history class was, I don't tell my students that this textbook is biased or that this textbook is, you know, not telling them the truth. I instead start all of my history classes now with like critical literacy. Like, you need to read for bias. And that is it's a study, it's a training that students need to understand, especially in the middle of the current event context we're in. A lot of students, I am fearing now, are losing that skill to like differentiate reality, like what is actual, there's factual information out there versus things that they see on like Netflix or hear on the news or politicians saying, right? So I feel like as first as social science teachers, our goal, our purpose needs to begin at teaching students critical literacy, especially in this day and age. So I think through that, they're able to then decipher, like, what does the textbook mean when it says, you know, indigenous people took a journey across the country, you know, with no context of, you know, guns at their backs being marched across this country. And if I just gave my students that one resource, that's what they would walk away with. That's what they would then believe to be true. So I feel like in my classroom, I make sure that it's critical literacy. I make sure to include sources that are primary sources, one. And then honor marginalized voices in my classroom and using those primary sources in particular. So how does, you know, the Cheyenne or the Lakota Sioux, how do all of these groups, when they're speaking their truth in their time period, how is that reflected in this textbook? Is it reflected in this textbook? And that's sadly, you know, I've talked to other teachers across my district in our work for ethnic studies, and we're all history teachers. That's how all of this kind of began in my district for ethnic studies. And, you know, even in seventh grade, they're saying, you know, give us a story of why Christopher Columbus is friendly. Well, let's see what he wrote. Let's see, you know, at the time period, he was even arrested by Spain, and that's saying a lot, right? So I think for my classroom, I definitely teach critical literacy, particularly even critical media literacy now. It's so important. A lot of primary sources and a lot of contextualizing. For systemic issues, luckily, my district has, you know, really paved a path forward in California for ethnic studies. They passed it as a graduation requirement through some of our grassroots efforts. And I do feel like having even the conversations of, you know, that this book may be biased, you know, like that's just the first step. I ultimately feel like there needs to almost be like a truth and reconciliation meeting with like teachers. And that it shouldn't be just scripted curriculum for history teachers, especially. Yeah, I feel like that would be one of the biggest, like, quick, easy, put history teachers in a actual session and have them dig into the work. And that way other teachers aren't coming into the classroom like wholly unprepared either. You know, and I'm always very cognizant of that fact. So, yeah.
That's huge. I think what you said about putting together a truth and reconciliation committee really rang true. And I think that something that you sort of ended with was that, you know, you're working now with other teachers, you're now working with teachers who are coming into the classroom. And I think that it's really important that we recognize that, you know, each one of our panelists are not just educators, but you're also, you guys are coaches, you're advisors, you're consultants, right? You're teacher educators as well as teachers. So maybe a last question that we could wrap up with is sort of what's your advice for, you know, schools of education, like our STEP program here at Stanford, teacher residencies, alternative certification programs, right? What have you, anywhere that teachers are trained, right? What's your advice about preparing teachers who are really, in Lauren's words, like equipped and prepared to bring this culturally relevant content into their classrooms? And I'd love to start with Bielka on this one and have others jump in as well.
I think we're just too dependent on the textbook. And I tell students, you know, this thing is good for you not saying stupid stuff like John Adams freed the slaves. After that, we don't need it. But I think we also use it too much for teacher educators. I think we don't teach teachers to read and research. It takes a lot, I think, as Lydia was saying earlier, for you to know what your options are to answer those inquiries you're developing. You just have to read a ton. And the textbooks are tertiary sources that aren't useful for that. And so you just got to read everything, read things that you've never heard of that you thought were irrelevant. Like, it's just a lot of reading. And from what I've seen in these programs that are just a year, they give you a couple weeks and they put you in a classroom. You might not have even studied that particular social science in undergrad, but you're meant to teach. And it's just, there's just no content at all, let alone, you know, even a discussion about it being sustaining. So I think the first thing then is for teachers to understand that they don't know a lot and to go find it on their own.
I think as a teacher who went through one of those programs that tossed you into a classroom with a summer's worth of training, I found myself falling back on the fact that I was a history major far more than I ever thought I would. And then I was surprised to actually find out that most of the history teachers around me had not majored in history, right? And weren't particularly well-versed in the content, right? And so I think what you're saying there really makes sense in terms of if you don't have that content knowledge, right, then you do sort of fall back on the textbook, right? Yeah.
I would add that the opposite is also true. And I wonder Andrew's thought on this, because particularly when we go into coach science and math teachers, they're content experts, but they're not necessarily kid experts, right? And so teachers are asked to do this extraordinarily impossible job of being content experts who continue to learn, kid experts who continue to learn, and I've got to navigate the safety net that now a school has become for our whole society, as we've seen when schools closed and the social net disintegrated. It's an impossible job. So I'm wondering, Andrew, from the science perspective, you were probably taught all science, right? If you have a life science credential, it's not like history where if I have a history credential, I can teach any history. In science, I think you have to have a particular credential, right? Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. And I was, you know, very fortunate, you know, at the college that I went to where I got a really wonderful breadth and depth of a variety of different scientific concepts and a liberal arts education. And I think that's been incredibly beneficial. Truly one of the most impactful and important things that I got in my teacher education to, you know, to become an educator. And this is, I'm going to circle back to something that Lauren said, like way back at the beginning, it was a class that started to examine our own identities. And I wish that had been a much bigger part of my, education to be a teacher. You know, it was like some of the first times that I'd had these real conversations with professors, with my peers, about what it means to experience the world as a white person and how that's like not a universal thing. I mean, I'm disappointed in myself that it took that age for that sort of to dawn on me. But if I hadn't gotten that then, I don't know when I would have. And so I would say you have to know your own identity in a pretty deep and nuanced way, in a way that's not typically a part of educational systems, in order to understand what that identity is and how you are biased, and to start to see the nuanced identities of your kids and really deliver more of what they need. And to kind of bring this back to the idea of these, you know, these textbooks and what they're emphasizing, you know, I'd even go for like, in STEM, you know, like a math textbook, you know, a penguin is represented by a cylinder and it weighs 4 grams. It's like, oh my gosh, you know, what am I even reading here? So, you know, textbooks are probably going to tell you like what and when, but they're not going to tell you how or why. And so you have a lot of opportunity to be creative with that. And teachers are creative. Teachers are great at problem solving like this. You know, they're always doing more with less. And so when you start to see that perspective, I think that you can, you know, almost realize that, you know, textbooks are fine and everything. They've got a lot of what and they've got a lot of when. But there's all these other places you can go for interesting content and for connections, to the point where, I mean, kids don't even like reading textbooks. So it's like the textbook isn't even necessarily the primary text of my class. It's informed things that I teach, but that's not the main thing we read. It's not the main thing that they're looking at. It provides me the information of kind of what I need to make sure I talk about, and the rest of it's up to me.
Thanks. I think you underlined so much that's important for teacher education, but especially the fact that identity work, right, and facing our identities and talking about our identities isn't something extra, right? It's really something that's critical and should be at the center of teacher education. Lydia, I'd love to hear from you on advice for teacher educators, for coaches, for advisors. And then Lauren, and then I think we have to wrap up.
Well, I think Andrew said it really well. I think teachers, new teachers need to remember that the institution of school was not created for Black, Brown, Indigenous, people of color. It was not created for them to succeed. That it wasn't created for them. And I think that Andrew really touched on it when he talked about the how, because we have to, our job is to really go in and figure out how we're going to help all students be successful in the world, right? Not just on the test, but in the world. Lauren talked about critical literacy. They need that because they have to go in, they have to go out and understand how to navigate the world successfully and all the different people and all the different situations that they're going to come into contact with in order to be successful. And so I think we need to focus more on the how we're going to do that. Mm-hmm. And make that our goal. How are we going to get all of these students and move them to the point that they can be confident, feel valued, and feel that they are capable to succeed in this institution that wasn't created for them, but then also out in the world?
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much. And Lauren, we'll let you have the last word.
Wow. So I would say that 6 years ago, I started teaching, and I do not believe that my program prepared me to teach the demographics that I teach. And I hate to say that, I really do. There wasn't a high emphasis on discussing anything about ethnicity, race, poverty. It was like the culture of poverty type of, you know, scenario. You know, students that are English language learners, like it was very surface level. And then when you get in your classroom, you know, it's not all just like English to Spanish and just Google Translate, you know, just really in depth of like, wait a minute, this student is, you know, a refugee coming from somewhere else and they're not even speaking Spanish. All of these various components that are not actually like in your practice in your classroom. So I feel like if anything, if my credential program would have explored that a little bit more, I feel like I wouldn't have been burnt out in my first couple of years of teaching. I'll also say like Hollyhock's program at Stanford, I will say I'm like probably still teaching because of that program, because of the tools and resources I learned in that program. In terms of how do you even have a discussion about some of these things in history, right? Like how do I talk about the Armenian genocide and there's descendants of Armenia in that classroom, right? Like, how do I talk about the Racero program and, oh, my grandfather, you know, these difficult histories. I think teaching how to have, you know, teaching history teachers how to teach history to the descendants that have been affected by history, if that makes sense. And then another layer I will leave us with is, I believe Lydia talked about it, is Black and Brown students, but also Black and Brown educators, right? Mm-hmm. There's another X factor there that is like a lot for this podcast to like take on. But I think in the context of teaching and you see that it's like traumatizing again, like, well, when I was a student, you're still doing this, but now I'm now the Black educator who has to be that voice consistently. And what would happen, and, you know, I'm lucky enough in my school, I do have great, great, great colleagues that are willing to like speak out and actually be anti-racist educators. But what would happen if some of my white colleagues did that heavy lifting? So I don't have to be that voice in the room, because when you're the voice in the room, sometimes it's, you know, well, I'm sure some of y'all know. So that's what I would leave it with, having that X factor of, you know, how do we prepare teachers of color even more to stay and not get burnt out as quickly as our white colleagues. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. You guys, I'm so grateful for this hour. I think that you've given us extraordinary things to consider tonight. Some very specific takeaways, Mike. I would offer things like having lunch with our kids, going to where they are on Instagram, going to where they are at the corner shop in the neighborhood. You know, these, we need to know our kids. And Lauren said it beautifully at the beginning, not just because we think we know them, but because we really know them. And creating a frame for ourselves that's intentional, being very intentional about our choices, as Andrew was talking about, creating a frame like Vielka was talking about, in with questions in service to an inquiry that our kids can prove to us and show to us what it is they're learning and sustaining them as learners. And I think with Lydia's framework for just a general guide for how to pick authentic texts, we've got a ton of takeaways here. So my extraordinary love and appreciation to our guests, Lydia, Andrew, Vielka, and Lauren, for being with us. That's it for Teaching to Meet the Moment. Next time, we'll be moving on from culturally sustaining content choices to culturally sustaining pedagogy, really engaging in that how and likely a bit of the why. So we look forward to anybody who wants to join us again live next week. Otherwise, I wish you well, and I wish you health, and thank you for all you do for our kids every day.
Thank you, all of you. This was awesome. Amazing.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.